First of all, I have one addition to make to last week's class. Okay. After that, I read another commentary, which is by, we think it's by Akagyupa from the 13th century, and it's the main commentary we use for Vinaya called Sotik. It's about 1,000 pages long. Anyway, he got into more about what the vows were made of, and he made it more clear. So I thought you might like to hear that, even though you already finished your homework and everything. He starts out this way. He says the sutras, the Dodepa, believe that the vows, when you take vows, pratimoksha vows, they exist as the continued intention to give up those bad deeds. And I like that he gives an example of the continued intention. And it's a monk thinking, just as he's about to do something, I shouldn't do that because that would be breaking my vows. So that's to them what the vows are made of. For the sutras, the second group of the four, they say the vows are made up of, the vows consist of, you're just about to do something wrong and you say, I shouldn't do that because I have vows. And that is the vows. Okay? That's according to the sutras. All right? Then the mind-only school comes along and says, what if someone's in deep meditation? Or what if a monk is in deep meditation? Or what if a monk is deep asleep? Well, are you saying they lose their vows? Like when a monk goes to bed he goes into REM sleep, and from midnight to four, he's not a monk anymore because he doesn't have vows anymore. And then the sutras say, well, how could he break vows if he was in deep meditation anyway? And then they give this example. There is a vow for fully ordained monks. And I'm not supposed to tell you all the vows. I have to tell you this one. That if you have been assigned to taking care of all of the monks' mattresses during the rainy season, and they've been hung outside, and they told you, you watch them in case it starts raining. You bring them in. And then everybody goes off somewhere. And then you go meditate in your room, and you go into this deep meditation. If during that meditation it starts raining and the mattresses get ruined, your vow's been broken at that moment. Okay, so the mind-only school says you must be able to break a vow even while you're in deep meditation. And if you don't have a vow, if the vow consists of thinking, I better not let those mattresses go to waste, and you can't have that thought when you're in deep meditation, then that's not enough. The vow has to be more than that. Okay? Confused enough? All right. So in other words, if the vow is the conscious thought, I shouldn't be doing this, then that guy can't break his vow at that moment. But the Buddha said he does break his vow at that moment. So then the mind-only school says, we have to add the bhakcha. We have to add the mental seed for that vow. And that's where the sabban comes in. That's where the seed comes in. The mind-only school says you better add the seed. Because even when he's not thinking about his vows, he can break his vows. Then along comes the Vaibhashika school, the first school, the Abhidhamma school. And they say, what if somebody is sitting before the abbot, and they're about to take their vows, and they have this intention to have vows and to give up bad deeds. They're thinking, I shouldn't do this. I shouldn't do anything bad. And they also have this seed for a vow at that moment. And they're just about to get their vow. Well, then they must have vows the moment before they get their vows, which is impossible because you didn't get the vows yet because the abbot didn't go like that. So your definition's not enough. Even the intention and the seed is not enough. It has to be the physical form of that guy at the moment that the abbot snaps his fingers and he's got vows. It must be the physical restraining from doing bad deeds and the physical restraining from saying things. Then people give the Vaibhashika a hard time. And they say, well, what about 10 minutes later when he's gone out of the room and he looks like a normal person again? Does he have vows or not? Because doesn't look like he has vows. You can't tell an hour later how he looks from someone who doesn't have vows. They look the same. Then the Abhidhamma school has to get into this special kind of invisible form that surrounds your body like an aura, or it's all through your atoms of your body, and then they say that's the vow. Then the Prasangika comes along, and you know what they say. They say it's like some kind of mental picture of having the vows. Okay, so anyway, that's how the argument goes. And it wasn't too clear last time, and I think now you get, especially about that mental seed. Why the mental seed? So how do the vows exist in you? You know, if you have vows, where are they? you know, if you take a razor blade, can you cut open and find the vowels or something? Where are the vowels? What's the difference between a person who has vowels and doesn't have vowels? Do they weigh an ounce more? You know what I mean? What are the vowels made of? And it's a very interesting question. You know, definitely you have vowels, but where are they? And what are they made of? So the higher school says something like the physical restraining of your body and speech as you imagine it or as you're thinking of it. Okay? Now we'll get down to today's subject. Gentle Kapa finished. He was going to give you Ngodani Rabi De Sosongodike right there. He was going to give you the divisions of the vowels, and we finished that. We finished the eight kinds of vowels. He makes one more division. He says you can split the vowels into two groups. Okay, we're going to cover that first. Two groups are these. By the way, before we go any further, I'd like to introduce and welcome Paco. I don't know how to say your last name, but he is Lama Yeshe's father. So very honored to have him here tonight. I'd like to welcome you. Okay. He did a big job. Say, Kimbe, Choki, Domba. Kimbe, Choki, Domba. Kim means a house. So Kimba is a householder. Okay, someone who has not yet left the family life. Kimba, householder. Kimbe. Choke is a tough word. Choke means this side or that side. Choke means one side or the other. In Sanskrit, it's paksha. And we'll talk about the word choke. It's important. You can say type here. Okay? Type or kind. Domba means what? Vowels. Okay? So all the eight kinds of pratimoksha vowels can be divided into vowels that relate to householders. And then Rabchung Choki Domba. Say Rabchung Choki Domba. Rabchung is short for Rabtuchungwa. Rabtuchungwa means really came out. And it means someone who has left the family life. Someone who's decided to leave the family life. Rabchung. Chok means that side or that type. Domba means vow. So vows which relate to those who've already left the home life. And here you have to know there's a kind of status that's halfway between being ordained and not being ordained. And it's called Rabchung. Okay? Rabchung is not one of the Bratimoksha vows. It's sort of a halfway house between not having vows and taking ordination. And it's where you undergo a ceremony where you agree to leave the home life. Okay? And you can start wearing red robes. And that's what the children in the monasteries are. They've taken a Rabchung commitment. We don't call it a vow. It's called Rabchungi Tsutrim. And it means they've agreed to go to a monastery and look, you know, start getting ordained or something like that. But it's not considered a pratimoksha vow. Okay, so these are, you could say, vows that relate to the ordained life and vows or having left the home life, and then vows that relate to those who are still living the home life, okay, householders. Normally you take a Rabchung commitment before you take your first ordination. There's a trick here. The reason they say chok, the reason they don't say vows of those who have left the home life or vows of those who have not left the home life, rather they say vows that relate to them, okay, there's a reason. And they give the example of someone who has already taken their Rabchung commitment. They've agreed to leave the home life, but they haven't taken their first ordination yet, which would be a novice ordination. So where do they fall? Let's say they took lifetime layman's vows, but they didn't take their first novice ordination yet. Where do they go? How many of the eight vows are here and how many are here? Let's start with that. First vow is what?
One-day vow.
So that's got to be...
So it's spring first?
Yeah, this is a one-day vow. And two?
Lay person, lifetime vows, male and the same.
Yeah, lifetime. Yeah, okay, layman. Ganyan Pama, yeah. And lifetime laywoman. So those are considered of this type. And then the other five are considered this type. In the root text it says, Kimbe Domba Dambo Sum, Rabchung Domba Tamanga. The first three are relate to people who have not yet left the home life, and the latter five relate to those who have left the home life. And the example we were talking about was somebody who has this vow, but already took this commitment. Where is he? He agreed to leave the home life, but he hasn't taken his he hasn't taken vow number 4 yet or 5. He hasn't taken a novice vow yet. That's why they have to say relate to. Okay, because technically he's still here, but he's already a rupture. Got it? And that's why they have to say choke. And it's a big deal in the Vinaya. So that's the basic division. You're either in this one or this one. If you have one of the first 3 vows, sets of vows, you're over here. If you have one of the latter 5 sets of vows, you're over here. Okay. Now we're going to start to talk about the first vow. He promised, Ngo dani rabye dan so so ngunzin kewe dan. Ngo, we finished. What's the vow made of? Rabye, we finished. What's the divisions and the groupings? And the third one is so so ngunzin. So so ngunzin means, well, what are the vows? Okay. What are the individual vows? And now we're going to start with the one-day vow. The one-day vow has 8 separate commitments. And they are divided into the 4 primary commitments and the 4 secondary commitments. I'll give you the Tibetan. Say mitangchu. Mitangchu. Mi means, I think you know, not. Okay. Mami, minme are the 4 negatives. Tsang means pure or clean. In Sanskrit, it's Brahma, but it means clean. Okay. And chu means activity. Unclean activity means sexual activity. Okay. It's a word for sexual activity. So mitang chu means for the length of 1 day you agree not to engage in sexual activity. The most serious would be adultery, right? Say majin len. Majin len. Ma means me, same, okay? Jin means given. Len means to take. To take what has not been given to you, okay? Stealing. Majin len. Classically, they try to set a limit, you know, like if you stole a pen from work, did you commit majin len? Which I was always wondering about because I do it all the time. And the limit is 1/4 of a karshapana. And that comes from Magadha in ancient India, and like it's some kind of monetary unit, all right? And even the Tibetans, like in Lucha Dhammabhadra's time, were debating how much is 1/4 of a karshapana. In fact, there's a whole little text in his collected works that where he discusses the value of 1/4 karshapana in terms that we can't figure out now anyway. So I asked Rinpoche, I said, how much is 1/4 karshapana? He says, I don't know. But he said, I guess it's somewhere between 1/4 and a dollar. Okay. I've heard 10 cents, I've heard 50 cents, I've heard a dollar. Something that someone would feel you stole. I think that's the bottom line, you know, something that someone would feel that you stole it, you know. Like I think a pen would probably be okay. And something that's worth a dollar, you know, like 3 pens or something, you know. It's like when would your boss start to object? You know, depending on your boss, right? Anyway, something of some kind of value. Okay, majin len. Of course it's not good to steal anything. Yeah. That's like going like this. And they do that. In scriptures. Fun to carve, I think. Say sokcha.
Sokcha.
Sok means life, cha means to cut. So this is killing. Killing. Most serious one is to kill miyam mirchakpa. Say miyam mirchakpa. Miyam mirchakpa. Mi means human being. Am means or. Mirchakpa means a fetus. In other words, to have an abortion or to cause an abortion. So miyam mirchakpa. That's the classic. I mean, when they ask the Dalai Lama, is abortion okay? This is all Buddhist scriptures say the same thing. They don't say killing a human. They say killing a human or a fetus. They always say that. So it's very cut and dry. It's very simple. Okay. Can't do it. Starts at the moment of conception. There's no debate about 9 weeks or 3 weeks. Okay? It's when the egg meets the sperm. That's the consciousness enters at that moment. So that's it. Can't do it after that. Okay. It's good to know because it's very dangerous because in our country it's considered okay right now. Number 4. Say dzunma.
Dzunma.
Dzun means false. Ma means to speak. And it means to lie. To lie. The biggest lie you can do, the classic lie, is to lie about your spiritual life. For example, the classic lie about your spiritual life is to say you've seen emptiness directly when you haven't. If you have, you know it, okay? So if you're not sure, you didn't. if you're not totally sure, you didn't. So that's the worst kind of lie. This is a total lie. These are called the basic four, the root four. The first half of the one-day vow. You have to keep these four. Avoid these four, right? Yeah. Sometimes they're called root, the four root vows. Sometimes they're called the four primary vows. Melcheto. Well, we'll do it in Tibetan. Say Melcheto. Melcheto. Mel is a difficult word. We don't have one word in English, but it means a seat and also a bed. I mean, because in Asia, normally you're sitting on your bed. It's a multi-purpose thing. So Mel can mean your seat or your bed. Che means big. To means high. And in this case, big means big value, like very expensive. To means exceeding one true. This is a true. It's made up of 24 source, and that's a gyangchak and dome, and you know, it goes like that. So anyway, it's using expensive furniture, something like that, luxurious furniture. In other words, you're supposed to, for that one day, try to live simply. And I can imagine that in our society, it would be like using your Mercedes rather than your Volkswagen for that day. You know, it just means avoiding luxury for that day, for that one day. I don't have this problem. It doesn't say that technically. It's just a luxurious seat or bed. But I think the spirit of the thing is, you know, avoid luxury for one day. Try to live simply. The one-day vow is trying to emulate an arhat for one day. You know, it's trying to live like a person who is incapable of having a bad thought for one day. That's the whole point of a one-day vow. And then if you keep doing that often enough, it might plant a seed in your mind, and maybe one day you actually start living that way. You know, Changtung. Say Changtung. Changtung. Chang is a Tibetan beer. Okay, alcohol. I once drank some by accident before I became a monk. And anyway, I won't talk about that. Tung means to drink. Okay, Changtung means to drink alcohol. And the scriptures always say here, Druam chume chang. Druam chume chang means it doesn't matter whether it's a naturally brewed alcohol or whether it's some chemical concoction like a drug that you've put together from chemicals artificially and not brewed. So it covers all kinds of intoxicants. Okay. This one covers drugs and alcohol. Yeah, it's always explained as Druam. This is the short version. Druam chime chang tuma. That's the full vow. There's a big debate about it. For a monk, it's quite strict. But I think in general, the modern lama's advice would be, you know, if you have to take some Novocaine or something, I mean, it's all right. The point is whether or not it lowers your inhibitions. That's the point. Say karsol. Tansol. Karsol tansol. Okay. Kar means dancing. Okay. Kar means dancing. Sok means etc. Cheng means like in India there was a custom of wearing these flower leis, these garlands of flowers around your neck. Like if you see women in still Karnataka state, they're still wearing, every morning they put a fresh flower in their hair and stuff like that. Cheng, sok means etc. I'm going to tell you what the etc. is referred to, okay? It's very specific. Kar is dancing or singing or playing music. Whenever you get into this point, you get all these objections from Western people. I'll summarize them because I also share them. What about religious music, you know? And then there's this debate about whether certain rock songs are religious. Or is it only Bach who's religious, you know? And then they say, what about, you know, holy dancing, you know, like lama dancing and stuff like that. You know, what about that stuff and what's the difference? And if I feel like it's religious, isn't it all right? The point is this, two things I've known about it. One is this mostly refers to something like a disco or something. I mean, it refers mostly to activity which would make you, would lower your general inhibitions and you would do something else. You know, like you start acting crazy in a little while and then you start doing something else. I mean, one point is that it's this kind of dancing or singing or playing music that would that you would do at a party, and that would eventually lead you to get a little wild and do something else that you shouldn't be doing. Okay, but the second point is deeper, and that's that at most levels, these three activities in almost any form would disturb your meditation. You know, and if you're musically inclined, you know that. You know, I used to not, you know, 8 years I didn't have any music in the house, and I used to go to the laundromat just so I could hear a few snips of songs, you know, and because they had these songs going all the time. And I would come back and try to meditate, and the song would be going, you know, the whole day. So it does really disturb your meditation. If you're trying to reach shamatha, which you must reach to see emptiness directly, this does disturb your mind. This does disturb your concentration. Not if you're a person like me, you know, I don't know. So I'd say at a certain level you'll see that these things might be disturbing to your meditation, and then they would actually block you from seeing emptiness. So that's very serious. In that case, you might want to lay off them for a while and see how it works. On a much, much higher level, you know, which is getting into the secret teachings, there might be something appropriate here. I can't talk about it, and no one should ever perform it in public, obviously. Okay? That's another point. Yeah. That's what I can't talk about that. Now you get into personal taste, you know. I think it would disturb your meditation, and I also think it wouldn't make you act crazy and hurt somebody or something like that, you know. So I'd say on level A, it's not going to make you wild like disco music and then make you hurt somebody or do something immoral. On the other hand, it will disturb your meditation. If your meditation gets serious, it'll start to disturb your meditation. If you reach a certain state of shamatha or close to shamatha, you'll find this quite disturbing. That's just my personal reflections on it. I mean, it's obviously they're meant to be activities that would disturb you spiritually, you know, and that's the point. With a lot of people, it calms them down. So, you know, I think it's at different levels. If you're on an everyday level, it might actually calm you down a little bit. If it's something you're going to go do at a club at 2 a.m. and go wild, it might actually hurt you. If you are in meditation or planning to be in meditation or you're trying to go on retreat or you're trying to gain shamatha, I think you must strictly avoid these things. If you are into the secret teachings deeply and you're some kind of huge yogi and you've done it for millions of years, which you know to be the requirement, right, perhaps it could take on a higher meaning. So I, you know, that's up to each person's level, I think. Yeah.
Historically, that when this might have been written, that might have been a group activity, a party, just by definition.
Could have been, but you have to be careful about that. I mean, people, I'd say be careful about the historical thing where they say, oh, that was India 2,000 years ago. It's not like that now. It is like that now. So, whatever reason the Buddha said not to do it in those days, the historical thing doesn't work very well. Usually, I'm just warning you, you know, people say, oh, that was back in India, you know. That they couldn't get angry back in India, but we realize that it's helpful to get it out, you know. It's not like that, yeah. Yeah.
In that case, the bow was disturbing meditation.
What was disturbing meditation?
The bow.
Oh, yeah. No, he's not supposed to go into meditation because he promises the other monks not to go into meditation. He's actually lied. He has agreed to take the responsibility, and then he's just drawn to his meditation seat, which never happens to us. He's already committed himself to take that responsibility in that case. Then you get into a thing in Vinaya called dom. And we're not going to go much into that, but it's called spiritual priorities, you know. Like when you have two good activities, but one of them is lesser than the other, you have to make prioritizations. And if he had not agreed, if he'd said, I'd rather meditate, I can't take responsibility for the mattresses, then it's okay. You know? But if he agreed to do it and then he goes to meditate, he breaks his vow. Okay. Cheng salt, I'll give you all of those. Those are the examples that Muchu Dhanbada gives. Those are pretty common. Nagarjuna also discusses this in his Surlekha. So if you're really interested in the one-day vow, you can check the letter to a friend. Yeah. Okay.
Now, with the first part with Garsu, would that include reading non-dharmic material?
No. Mm-hmm. Just specifically these things, because they make you a little bit wild, insofar as they might make you lose your inhibitions. Okay. That's the point of those. Say, Chidra. Kase. Chidra means the latter part of the day, meaning afternoon. Kase means food. It means eating after noon. So on the day that you take a one-day vow, you have to keep the commitment that traditionally monks kept in the old days, which was not eating anything after 12 o'clock. And there's this whole ritual and this whole book's written about how you measure noon. You know, you take a stick of a certain size and you stick it in the ground and you check the shadow and it's too late to eat. You know? Okay. In your part of the world, it's all this complicated thing. Anyway, the bottom line is arhats don't eat much. They eat once a day. They go out and beg for their food once, and they eat once, and then it's over with. No more washing. No more thinking about food. No more going to the grocery store. It's a great relief off your mind. Then your mind is free for the rest of the day to think about holy things, and it's very liberating, and it also makes you very light, and it allows you to think clearly for the whole latter part of the day. You can drink anything except milk, and that's considered a food, and yogurt. You know, you can drink watery milk. That's the thing, you know. Generally, like, fruit juice is okay, and things like that. But milk is considered a food, and yogurt would be, like a milkshake or something, would be considered a food. I like that. And those are the four secondary parts of a one-day vow. In the Tibetan monastic tradition, when you become a monk, you can declare that you're going to keep it or not. It's called gongche. Gongche means cut off the evening. And when you take your vows, normally, I mean, just talking local Tibetan tradition, you keep it for a while, and then you start eating in the afternoon. But there are some monks who keep it their whole life. So you're really supposed to keep it your whole life. But that's just the way the tradition has developed. Particularly, it's considered that you should use common sense. You know, if you're working hard, like if you're out working in the fields for the monastery and you should be eating something, if it would hurt your body not to eat in the evening, you're not supposed to be fanatic. You're supposed to use common sense, you know. If you're working in a busy office and you couldn't get out before 12 o'clock, even if you've taken this vow, you can, you know, you're supposed to eat something and keep yourself strong. Common sense is very important in Vinaya, and it's part of Vinaya. You know, there's a thing called miksa, which means exceptions, and Vinaya is full of exceptions, depending on common sense, about your hair, about your clothing, about a lot of the details. There are written into the Vinaya situations where if it helps many people, if it's something good, if your lama tells you to do it, you should do it. Yeah, and in the Hinaya Vinaya, there are miksas. There are special cases where if your lama says, you got to go to work, I want you to wear a suit, you have to wear a suit. And the Vinaya says, for 10 hours if he says 10 hours, for 24 hours if he says 24 hours, and for your whole life if he says your whole life. So, you know, you have to study Vinaya deeply. It's a long story. If you've taken higher vows, it's even more important to be sensible, take care of yourself, do what's compassionate. You cannot stretch the rules which are meant to, like the rule of celibacy. There's no exceptions to that. Never. There's no case where it would be more compassionate to break it. No, Jetsun Kapa covers that. He covers that. No, he covers that. Well, the example he gives is, what if a lady says she'll commit suicide or something like that? And then he says, you have to give back your vows first and then do it. But you can't, as a monk, you cannot never break that. And other things like that. Okay. His Holiness would say, I'll tell you when it happened. Okay. Say, Taichen, Sojong. Taichen, Sojong. And Nyenne. Okay, Nyenne is the one-day vow, which is the first of the eight pratimoksha vows, which is what we've been talking about so far. That's a pratimoksha vow. That's part of the Vinaya. There's another one-day vow called Taichen Sojong. And I don't want you to get confused between the two, so I'm mentioning it. It's not mentioned in the Vinaya. Okay? Taichen Sojong is a custom. Taichen means Mahayana. Mahayana. Okay? Which already takes it out of the realm of Vinaya. So means to repair. Jong means to purify. And so it's like a one-day vow of purification. This is a practice which is current among the Mahayana schools. And we do it on big holidays, for example. We get up before dawn. We take the 8 precepts, same 8 precepts. And then until the next morning, the trick, the point at which you lose the vow is the following morning at dawn. So you have to finish it before daylight normally. And then when you can see the lines on your hand, on your palm, from the natural light in the sky, well, then the vow is over. So I've had friends who were sitting with these cookies and watching their hand, you know. It's actually a story like that. So this is a Mahayana vow. What's the difference if the parts of the vow are the same? What's the difference? There's two big differences that I'm aware of. The motivation is different. What's the motivation for taking any Pratimoksha vow?
To get away from suffering.
Just to get away from samsara and reach nirvana, which is a mental state. Okay? It's not reaching Buddhahood. It's not reaching enlightenment. It is that golden porthole where you put your mind and you can never again be unhappy, period. Impossible. Cannot have a mental affliction. Impossible. Definition of nirvana. Because you saw emptiness directly and practiced a lot, then you can never be shaken out of that state of happiness. Nothing can shake you out of that state of happiness. Your whole world is still screwy. Your body is still doomed. Your relationships are doomed. Your career is doomed. Everything's screwy. But your mind is totally unshakable and happy. That's the motivation for taking Nyene and any other Pratimoksha vow. But the motivation for taking Techen Sojo is, I want to become a Bodhisattva. I want to reach total enlightenment. I want to get through that golden hole and move on to total enlightenment, where my whole world is paradise, and I want to drag everybody else. I want to be an example for everyone else. I want to be able to bring along everyone else with me through that place to a total happiness. And that's the motivation. So motivation is different. Also, there's this detail where if a person with a higher Pratimoksha vow takes a lower Pratimoksha vow, it ruins his higher vow. Okay. Like if a full monk takes a novice vow again, it ruins the full monk's vow. Can't do it. It pushes out the... It's like contradictory. You can't go back to a lower ordination without giving up the higher ordination. So a monk, for example, cannot take this vow, cannot take this one-day vow in the Hinayana as a Pratimoksha vow. But a monk must certainly, often as possible, take a Mahayana one-day vow. So that's another difference. Okay, you can't take a lower vow in the Pratimoksha system, but monks are happily take this vow, okay, which is trying to emulate the high bodhisattvas for the length of 1 day. Yeah, this is a bodhisattva vow. Oh, sure, yeah. Can a lifetime layman, I don't know, I've got to check that out. Maybe not. I'll check it out, I'm not sure actually. Do you guys know? I don't know. I would guess maybe not, but I'll check it out. I'm not sure, I'll ask Rinpoche. I have a feeling maybe not, because you've already committed to it, most of it. But I'll check it out. You know, there is a, I won't get into that. There is a kind of vow where you do agree to take it every day for the rest of your life. And I think that's a higher vow, but then that gets complicated. And I don't think that's a real higher vow. It's a nominal higher vow. Okay, anyway. Next we're going to do the lifetime lay person's vows. Okay. I think this is the highlight of the course for a lot of people here. Okay. I mean, a few people came up to me already and said, can I take lifetime layman's vows? And I said, it'd be wonderful, but wait a while, let me see if I can catch more people. Okay. It's very easy, actually. There's 5 vowels and there's 1 additional part, okay? So we'll go through them mostly in English. But this is to, sepa means to kill. Mi means a human being. Am means or. Mir chakpa means a human fetus, okay? So killing a human or a human fetus. That's the first thing you vow not to do. And this is jisit soy pardu, which means for the length of your life, until you die. The moment you die, you lose these vows. These are Pratimoksha vows. Right. I mean, technically speaking, the lifetime layman's vows are pretty easy to keep. Okay, they are big time bad deeds. Technically speaking, you know, they are really, it's pretty hard to do them. Okay, except for abortion. I mean, that's pretty. I think this one might be, I mean, as I think about it, this would be the most difficult one. This one might be very difficult, actually. I mean, there was a point in the translation of the Buddhist scriptures into Tibetan when the king said, I want all measurements expressed in Magadha units. Magadha is like one part of central India, you know. So all the weights, all the lengths, all the times, all the monetary was expressed in units that were current, you know, down in India at that time. So it's Kashyapana. And as we said, a quarter Kashyapana, think of it like 25 cents to a dollar. That's from Rinpoche, and Rinpoche is one of the probably the last three or four greatest scholars of Vinaya in the world. So if he doesn't know, I don't know if we're going to find anybody that knows. He started to convert it to Tibetan currency, and then he said, but that's all over now. And you know, Muchu Dhammapada converted to Tibetan currency of his day, but that was 200 years ago, and we don't really know. So stealing anything of value, I think that's hard. There's a long discussion in the Vinaya why cheating on your taxes is stealing, for example. I mean, all kinds of cheating and things like that are stealing more than a quarter Kashyapana. So that's tricky. You have to be careful about it. It's just they discuss it specifically.
And you take the same tax in your office, but you don't realize you're different.
I don't know if you have to. There's a Shi Samba Jor Tatu. Whenever you do a bad deed, there's what the thing is, what your motivation was, did you undertake to do it, and did you complete it? And normally all four have to be there for a big karma to be created. I'm not sure, but I don't think if you, for example, kill a person in a car accident, that I don't believe you would break this vow. Okay? If you're not conscious of it, I don't believe you would break it. I believe you have to have a motivation. You have to have premeditation. Normally, even if it's only a moment of anger, you know, 20 seconds of milliseconds of anger, and then you kill somebody or something. But you got to have some kind of forethought about it. Normally. Okay, number three. The Dhammapada mentions two versions of this lying about your spiritual life. One is a direct, total lie, and very typically, I've seen emptiness directly or something like that. That's the classic one. But then he goes into a discussion. I don't know if it was him or Tony Dabashiru, but it was. Then they go into a discussion of why certain other kinds of lies that imply you have spiritual realizations are also come under this category. And he mentions people who come up to you and say they can see your future life, or they can see what you were in the past, or things like that, or even to imply it, or to claim that they have some miraculous powers or something like that. Because that implies that you've seen emptiness directly and stuff like that. You see, if I say I can see my future lives, since that's something that happens right after you see emptiness directly, then that's implying that you've seen emptiness directly when you haven't. And that's another kind of lie. You know? Yeah.
So you're saying that they're saying it's impossible for people to have psychic powers or anything unless they've seen emptiness directly?
No, not saying that. You can possibly see some things before you see emptiness directly.
Right.
You always see them when you see emptiness directly.
Right.
But it is possible, like for a non-Buddhist who's very good at meditating, to see a future life.
Right.
And that's possible. But most times it implies that you've reached some high level. And even if you've seen emptiness directly, it's part of the experience that you would never tell anyone directly. You'd never get up there and just say, on July 70, five, I saw emptiness directly, or something like that. You can't do that. They wouldn't do it. So if someone gets up and says it, you have to be careful. I'm not saying that person's definitely lying, but it probably have to be some extraordinary circumstances.
Could you do that sometimes with your bodhisattva vows, so you're a moral authority or something?
Extremely rare, because it's not a good way to prove yourself, because it cannot be confirmed by the other party. And that's one of the big reasons why you don't have to talk about it. They can't confirm it anyway. You know, you can claim to have seen anything, but they can't confirm that. it's better to use logic or something that they are grounded in. Use some reason that that pertains to what they already accept and what they can already access. But don't make some claim that they could never confirm anyway, because then somebody else can come along and make some weirder claim, you know. And if they're going to believe yours, they're going to believe theirs, and then they're going to get all messed up. So, like that. Not committing adultery with another person's spouse. Technically, the text says with someone who's not your wife, but as I've always had it taught to me, it specifically refers to another person's spouse, as opposed to general sexual misconduct. It's not sexual misconduct in Buddhism between consenting adults of the opposite sex. That's not sexual misconduct, and it's not adultery or like that. If one of them's not married to someone else. Okay. But there's a lot of other kinds of sexual misconduct which we'll cover. I believe it is adultery. Yeah. I believe that would be adultery. Yeah. I believe you taught me. Yeah. Okay. I believe that would be included here in adultery. You know, I don't know where I heard it, but it's one of these Dharma rumors, you know, where I heard you can take this one or not take this one, or you could take these four and not commit yourself to number five. You know, I thought I heard that somewhere, and I know there are different kinds of ganyans. There's ganyan where you take only one, there's a ganyan where you only take two, but then technically you have to take all of them, and Dharmabhadra makes a point of saying you can't drink alcohol, period. If you take these vows, you can't. You can't take any kind of intoxicants. And then I've often quoted, you know, where the Buddha himself says, it's in the Abhidhamma, Kosha, quoted from Sutra, he takes a blade of grass, he holds it up, and he says, anyone who drinks the amount of alcohol that you could hold on the tip of this blade of grass, or serves it to another person, don't call yourself a Buddhist. You know, don't say you're following me. So, quite clear. I can show it to you anytime. And it's just not worth it. I mean, it makes you stupid. It wastes money. It hurts your body. There's just no point to it. And you won't miss it much if you give it up. The last, there's an additional part, okay, on your homework it says something like, additional part. You also commit yourself to this when you take a lifetime layman's vows. Oh, sorry, additional part. Which means never breaking the advices on going for refuge. Okay. There are what they call unique advices and there are common advices. I'm not going to cover the whole thing in this class, but basically, the essence of the advices on going for refuge is never to give up, most especially the Dharma refuge, okay? The Dharma jewel. And in this case, it refers to hurting other people. So the essence of all the advices on refuge, in other words, if you claim to be a Buddhist, then one thing you must absolutely give up is hurting other people. Okay? Doesn't mean if you ever hurt someone, you've broken your Ganyan vows. No. This means more like philosophically, when you say, that's all BS, I don't believe it anymore. You know, I don't think there's any point to trying not to hurt other people. I mean, this is a very serious thing. And that would be breaking the advices on going for refuge. That's the essence. Yeah. In the Abhidharma, joining the army is called a Domba Mayimba. It's taking an anti-vow. And you get that same invisible aura once you swear that you will bear arms against another being. You get that same aura. And until such time as you resign from that organization, you have what's called an anti-vow in your mind stream. That same thing. Or if you swear I'll be a butcher for a period of, you know, the next year or so. If you say I promise to study butchering and animals and it grows in your mind stream like the other vows, like a pratimoksha vow. That's a Abhidharma, in the Abhidharma. No, not like that. You can eat meat, and it's not considered necessary in Buddhist philosophy to give up the eating of meat, technically. It's strongly encouraged. But the point that lamas would say is that when you go to the store to buy meat, you don't say, I'm going to the store to kill a cow. You say, I'm going to the store to buy meat. Okay, now you have to kill a cow to buy meat, but you're not doing the killing. You can't kill a cow. A cow can't be killed specifically for you. You can't go to a farm and they say, we're having dinner tonight, and since you're a special guest, we're going to kill a cow for you. In that case, you've broken the vow against killing. Because, by the way, any time that you instigate someone else to do any of these things, it's equal to committing it. So now, if no one ever paid for meat, they would stop killing animals. And there's big debates about it, okay? And there are sutras which say don't eat any meat and like that. But there's also, there's big debates about it. Basically speaking, the viewpoint currently is that, the viewpoint throughout Buddhism has been, I think it started when monks had to beg for their food. And you weren't allowed to reject anything, you know. So you weren't allowed to say, I like that, I don't like that. So whatever they put in your bowl, you were supposed to eat. And that would often include meat, or it could include meat. So it wasn't, there's never been in the Vinaya or any other place else, technically, something that says you can't eat meat. You cannot kill an animal. And what? These are, well, there are other traditions where there are other kinds of vows or other sets of vows. Like in Thailand, you can take monk's vows for 3 months, or you're even encouraged to do that in Thailand. We follow what's called the Sarvastivadin group of Hinayana vows, Theravadin vows. It's one of 18 groups. There are other sets of monk's vows were recognized in ancient India. This is the one that was accepted in Tibet and followed in Tibet by all monks in Tibet. They're not much different. The sets of vows are very little different. There is, as far as we know, and we have most of the root texts on Vinaya, there is no other pratimoksha vow than these 8. The Abhidharma teaches 8, though all the Abhidharma scriptures teach 8. There's no other set beyond the 8 that's in any kind of current copy of the ancient scriptures that mentions any other ones. Not that I'm aware of. There are, you know, in Burma and Thailand, they keep a slightly different number of vows, but basically it's all the same. Okay. Take a break, and we'll come back in 5 or 10 minutes. When you hear the bell, dong, we can arrange it with Rinpoche, you know. And it's very wonderful. It's very nice to have them. It changes your spiritual capacity. It changes your, what do you call it? Your sensitivity to Dharma. It actually changes your ability. It changes how you... receptivity to Dharma. It changes a lot. So if there's any way, if you have any idea to take it, take it. And once you know them clearly, they're not that difficult, right? It's not like, you know, small lies or stuff like that, you know. Yeah.
I'm just a little saying it's from the Vinaya that you read from the Vinaya, as you mentioned, Burma, Thailand.
Yeah.
They're not so specific. Like, they'll say lying for number 3 or just stealing. Or
I think they just didn't, you know, when I was taking the vows, they didn't explain them to me very carefully. I didn't know they were this specific either. Yeah, they do. And this is what they really are. This is what comes from the Vinaya. And you should know, in Tibet, there's like 16 volumes of the original Vinaya text, 16,000 pages. And the commentaries run into the thousands, tens of thousands probably. And they're very clear. They're very cut and dry. They all pretty much agree on all these points. These points are, you know, it's very, very nice, very clear. They saved many, many scriptures in Tibet. Many scriptures reached Tibet. And because of the inaccessibility until the airplane was invented, they were kept very, very pure. And so even the Theravadin traditions in Tibet are extremely pure and more detailed than in countries. I've been to Sri Lanka. I've been in the monasteries there. I've lived in Thailand. You know, we're very fortunate in Tibet. We have a very, very, we're extremely fortunate. In St. Petersburg, we have 100,000, 200,000 scriptures in Tibetan, and they're just extraordinary. And it really is a very, very, not just bragging, but I went to Thailand. I said, show me your canon. It was 45 volumes left. You know, thin volumes left. We have about 200,000 in Tibet. I mean, we really do have the original scriptures in pretty good shape, and we have unbelievable commentaries from the early Indians all the way up to the 19th, 20th century. They're wonderful. So we're really lucky. We really are fortunate.
Okay. We're going to talk just a touch about Getsu.
This is a novice monk. It's a Rabchun Choki Domba. Okay. It's an really what you could consider an ordination. And there's different ways of dividing their vows. I'm going to talk about the most basic way, and I'm not going to go into details on their vows because we're reaching the point at which I can't tell you everything. You have to take it before I can tell you everything. But we're going to do it very broadly speaking. Say, Tsawa Shi.
Tsawa Shi.
Tsawa Shi.
Tsawa Shi.
Tsawa means root. Shi means four, the root four. So you've already had those. To agree to give up those for the length of your life is the root four. On top of that, say yenlak tu.
Yenlak
tu. Okay, yenlak means the secondary vowels. And in this case, there are six. Before we had how many?
Four.
Before we had four and four. Now we have four and six. These six are arrived at, Aura and me and Ellie spent like 2 hours on this last night. They're arrived at in the following way. Remember before we had dancing, etc., and flower garlands, etc. We'll just split those into two. So dancing, etc., becomes one separate secondary vowel, and flower garlands, etc., becomes another vowel. Then you get one extra, which makes five secondary vowels. Okay? You split one into two, you get five. Okay? We were confused for about an hour, so you're getting it the easy way. On top of that, you add handling money, like keeping money, handling money. I believe that traditionally you weren't supposed to have any period. Yeah, I think you... I don't know, to tell you the truth. And I don't know if I could go into it. But generally, for example, you weren't even allowed to keep food. You weren't allowed to keep more food than you could eat that day. So I don't think you'd be allowed to keep money. Now, obviously nowadays people do. So that makes six... And then you have a third group, which is called, say, Langde, Sum. Langde, Sum. Langde is a difficult word to translate. Lang means to take. De means to transgress. And what it means is to transgress certain commitments that you have taken from a preceptor or a Kempo. Okay. So it means a transgression. Okay. Long day means a transgression. And sum means three. All right. Number three. Roughly speaking, they consist of disrespecting the person who gave you your vows. Failing to give up the appearance of a lay person. In other words, wearing your hair long or wearing lay clothes. And then the third one is failing to take up the appearance of a monk. In other words, shaving your head and wearing robes. Those are the three. And there's all sorts of technicalities, and I'm not going to go into it. Okay. And there's all sorts of mixed cells and things like that. This makes a total of how many vowels? Yeah. So normally we speak of the 10 basic ones and the three transgressions and the basic structure of the vow for a novice, monk, or nun, same thing, are these 13. Now there's, the long days can be divided up and you come out with 30-something, and I'm not going to go into that. But basically, this is the basic structure of a novice vow, to take those for your life. And that's about all we're going to do tonight, okay? Yeah. Generally they're considered secret, but in practice, if you've taken a Rabjun commitment, you've already been in a monastery, you know pretty much what they are. And in practice, my Lama, for example, sat me down and taught them to me before. And I think in practice you end up doing that. Once the person has committed themselves or something like that. But I don't know. I haven't read yet the real exact reason why. I know that when Jetsun Kapa covers the Bodhisattva vows, he says these are the only vows of the three kinds of vows that you can learn ahead of time in detail. So it is true. Now, why, I don't know exactly. I know that it's considered breaking the or it's considered a violation to let people who don't have ordination to witness certain ceremonies of Vinaya, or to be present in certain ceremonies of Vinaya. And that's very strict. So maybe it has to do with that, or I don't know. But I know that that's covered in the Vinaya. But I've never seen, like, in the Vinaya, and I haven't studied it, I haven't studied the huge text, but I haven't seen a specific section where they say, this is why we don't teach people their vows ahead of time or something. This is why you can't study in detail the monk's vows or something like that. But I haven't seen that yet. It's probably there somewhere. Yeah. Yeah, I don't. The layman's vows you can study ahead of time, but the especially the full monks and full nuns vows you're not allowed to study. I haven't seen an explanation of exactly why. Although in practice, I think good lamas try to make sure that their students understand all the vows, and I know that when you take the vows, they don't form unless you, in your mind, are ready to commit to all of them. And I don't know how you could do that if you didn't know them all. Like, if you have reservations about any of them, they don't form properly. So I'll have to defer that one till later. Yeah. I can't say. Don't know exactly. Yeah. This is the problem of reading something somewhere. I'm not sure about it. But I don't know. I'll ask Rinpoche. We'll see. I don't know exactly why. All I really am aware of is that it's very strict that you cannot witness Vinaya ceremonies and things like that. Maybe it's connected to that. I don't know. But why it would seem to be beneficial? It'd be beneficial for the sangha if they knew everyone knew exactly what their bells were. You know. And I think in countries, like I was in Sri Lanka, and a typical TV show in Sri Lanka is discussing how long a monk's hair can be. And so I know in Sri Lanka, it's pretty, everyone knows. So I'll ask Rinpoche, I'll see. But I've studied a number of texts in Vinaya, but I've never seen a direct explanation of why that's the case. All right, we'll do about 5 minutes, meditate. This meditation is very hard because you're thinking about going home. So try to think about how lucky you are to have a class like this and meditate on that. And maybe try to consider whether you want these secret invisible wings or not. Okay.